From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, gives us an update of news and events from around Latin America and the Caribbean.
The big news for everybody in the region, of course, is the spate of natural disasters that have included the hurricanes that have affected almost all the Caribbean and Florida.
And an earthquake.
And also Mexico, although Hurricane Catcher turned out not to be as destructive as Irma.
Right.
Or even Harvey.
Yeah.
But also Mexico was very badly affected by what seems to be the strongest earthquake for over 100 years.
Yep.
Which in effect is really saying the strongest earthquake on record.
Yeah, which also, I mean, it comes on the heels. They were saying that Irma for a while was the most powerful storm that has ever happened in the Atlantic, and so, which in other words, the most powerful hurricane ever also in recorded history.
Right. And yeah, and it looks as though the climate change skeptics are going to have a lot of explaining to do, although they'll probably have some glib patter already lined up to explain why it's not climate change. Here in the region, people are taking it very seriously, in Nicaragua's position has ever since the Paris, or even before the Paris Accord, the so-called COP22, and people are getting ready now for the next conference of parties, the COP23 on climate change within the UN framework for climate change. I think it's being held later sometime in the end of November, December, but there are already meetings going on preparing for that. And obviously they'll be paying a lot of attention to the events that we've had over the last couple of weeks. And of course the hurricane season isn't over by any means. I'm here in Nicaragua, in Central America, and people remember Hurricane Mitch, which happened on the 28th of October in 1998.
Yep.
And so that's, you know, what's that, 15 years ago now?
Yeah,
no,
it's 19 years ago.
Yeah, and getting on for that. So, people here are very, very conscious of how vulnerable our region is to the effects of natural disasters, so-called natural disasters. And people are rightly questioning that kind of description. You know, can we describe disasters like the massive hurricanes and earthquakes that have been happening as natural when it's so obvious that human activity has contributed to the climate change that we're currently suffering?
And also, you know, I don't know anything about this particular earthquake or even the geology of, the southern part of North America and Central America, other than where you guys are is almost like a mud bar between the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. And so it's pretty shaky ground to stand on, literally. But, you know, in Central North America, for example, you know, in the Great Plains states and in others, they lay a lot of earthquake activity that's happened in places that were relatively stable before on the extraction of natural resources from the ground, causing huge gaps, and particularly oil and gas, which are the things that they're burning that are creating the problem with climate also.
Yeah, so that, of course, compounds the climate change that's happened as a result of emissions of carbon dioxide and so forth. But getting back to the earthquake in Mexico, this record earthquake, and a total of over 2 million people have been affected in southwestern Mexico, mainly in the states of Oaxaca and Chiapas, which are the two of the poorest states in Mexico. So as usual, it's the most vulnerable, the most economically vulnerable populations that are suffering the worst effects.
Yep.
Of the hurricane, and there I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, but the last figure I saw was that between 90 and 100, maybe a few more people have died as a result of the earthquake. But there's massive material damage in areas where adobe constructions were very common.
Right.
And so, and that you're looking at, you know, what the role of the Mexican authorities in failing to insist on adequate building standards and all that whole series of that whole area of, you know, to what extent are the authorities concerned responsible for not protecting their population? And it's very difficult to see how Mexico is going, and that's a very serious economic blow for Mexico as a whole, not just for the regions affected. And that's also true, of course, in the Caribbean.
Sure.
And one of the shocking things that was reported, I saw a report in Teleso, I mean, you may well have seen it too, is that in the island nation of Antigua and Barbuda was completely destroyed
leveled.
By Hurricane Irma.
Yeah, leveled, yeah.
And the IMF are refusing to give debt relief to Antigua and Barbuda to mitigate the economic effects of the hurricane, which is quite outrageous.
As a matter of fact, what's interesting at Telesur, they have a video that says, calling it as it is, Hurricane Chevron.
Right. Yeah. So, and of course, in the United States, and I haven't been following it closely. You may well have followed it more closely than me. The controversy over what Exxon was telling the public about climate change, when in fact its own scientists were telling it a very different story.
Yeah, that's right.
So the role of the big energy companies and of corporate capitalism in general, in terms of both its role in being an agent exacerbating climate change, and also its financial role, the financial role of corporate capitalism in exploiting the disasters take place, and the way the United States government in particular, but not just the United States government, its NATO allies too, like Canada and France in particular, in the case of Haiti, they exploit these natural disasters, earthquakes and hurricanes, to consolidate their tyrannical grip.
Yep.
On the political options that countries in the region can develop or are allowed to develop. And of course, and if you look at the way Cuba manages these disasters, of which it is a regular victim because of its geographic location.
Right. Yeah.
And if you look at the way Nicaragua, for example, has learned from both from Cuba and from other institutions, international institutions with experience in disaster prevention and relief. And if you look at the way Venezuela deals with these disasters, and it's in particular its solidarity-based response over many years, it's very clear that the political model that countries like Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua are trying to promote, which is obviously a socialist-inspired model in Cuba's case, directly a revolutionary, Marxist-Leninist revolutionary model, insisting on an alliance between the state, the authorities of the state, and people at grassroots in order to combat the effects of these disasters. And if you contrast that with what's happened, you can see we saw it in Katrina, didn't we?
I was going to go there. That's exactly right. The perfect contrast is, let's say, the current hurricane that we're going to see the response to, and we've seen a response to in Cuba, as opposed to Katrina, where internal imperialism or internal colonialism saw the powers that be essentially take advantage of the fact that people were either evacuated or drowned out of their homes, seizing, just stealing the land outright, and handing it to developers to, you know, build a new New Orleans that doesn't have all those pesky poor black folks hanging around and other poor folks, and instead, you know, 50 or 100 of those old homes make a great site for some luxury condos, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the same corporations that benefited from the disastrous U.S. invasion of Iraq, they destroyed the country so as to hand their corporate allies juicy reconstruction contracts, some of which never even came to fruition. And that same model was applied in New Orleans, wasn't
right,
it?
And that's correct.
The same corporations benefited from contracts. And the local authority, Mike Pence at the time, was there's something called the Republican Study Committee. And Mike Pence was the president of that committee at the time. And their policy recommendations were to scrap employment protections and environmental regulations
right.
to enable corporate reconstruction.
Right.
And one of the measures that they took back then was to scrap public schooling effectively.
That's right.
And impose these charter schools.
Yep.
Which led to massive layoffs in the education sector.
Yep. Just about every public sector, public property, public interest, everything that was outside of the control of the, you know, of super capitalists, basically, was wrested away and handed to them, under the cover of Reconstruction. And not only did that happen, in other words, not only did the law allow that and the political establishment, develop and enforce that, but they also used our money to facilitate it. They gave them tax breaks, public financing, and everything else. So it was what they call a public partnership. You know, it was all the liabilities are public and all the benefits are private.
Right, yeah. So and obviously, I don't know what the situation is in Houston and Texas at the moment, but we're likely to see similar kinds of corporate exploitation of the disaster and for profit.
Yeah.
Some analysts and writers have pointed out quite correctly, in my opinion, that as far as the corporate capitalist agenda in relation to climate change is concerned, they're not going to try and stop climate change. They see it as a profit opportunity. So it's not. So there's a very even in these extreme cases of great human suffering, widespread human suffering and privation provoked by these natural disasters, you can see this very clear contrast between the cruel, brutal, savage corporate capitalist model looking for profit at every opportunity, and the solidarity-based socialist-inspired revolutionary model of the authorities in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela in particular.
Yep.
And Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, is very clear about that. You know, and he was quoted on Telesur as saying that corporate capitalism is essentially what has provoked or certainly exacerbated the worst effects of the natural disasters derived from climate change. And in much of the region, many people agree with him.
Right.
So that's just another kind of theatre, isn't it, of the overall conflict between two very distinct models: the dying corporate capitalist model, dying at a world level, although it may still be on its feet in countries like the United States and Western Europe.
And it's trying to take us all with it.
Yeah. And the model of countries like Venezuela, Cuba, these were the countries that designed Petrocaribe and the Bolivarian alternative for the Americas, explicitly prioritizing solidarity-based cooperation against the kind of corporate capitalist competitive model that has failed humanity so disastrously and as we can see in this latest spate of earthquakes and hurricanes. Yeah. And it'll be very interesting to see how Mexico decides to respond to this, what is in effect the worst earthquake they've ever suffered, and its effects. And it'll be very interesting to see the contrast between the way Cuba and the Caribbean island nations that are a part of Petrocaribe are able to recover, and how they cope with the failure of the United States and its allies to adequately respond to the effects of these catastrophes. In fact, one interesting detail that I saw was that the Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin has already committed to helping Cuba recover from this disaster, because in Cuba, as I think as you said earlier, that Hurricane Irma was the worst hurricane that's ever hit Cuba.
Yeah.
And so the effects are likely to be very strongly felt there and take a long time for Cuba to overcome. And of course, at a time when the United States is insisting on maintaining its completely illegal and in effect genocidal sanctions regime, its blockade.
Yeah, right. You would hope that at least there'll be some sort of relief for the reconstruction period from that, but I wouldn't spend that hope on anything. You know, yeah. You've got Naomi Klein's. In any event, she helped popularize the idea of disaster capitalism as a thing, and you see it, you know, all the time. I mean, certainly we've seen this phenomenon long before she identified and popularized it, and I don't necessarily buy her whole application and, you know, an almost commodification of that concept, you know, the phenomenon certainly is real, that there are many different industries that really feed very well on disaster and on the victims of disaster, I think is probably the most accurate way of putting it.
Yeah. And going back to the contrast between the U.S. capitalist, corporate capitalist response to these disasters and the solidarity-based response, and it's Venezuela that's currently another victim of U.S. sanctions that has been the first responder in terms of, in particular, in terms of Antigua and Barbuda. But of course, that's if you read the Western corporate media, and that's kept very quiet, isn't it? It's kept very quiet that Venezuela immediately supplied two military transport planes to get in supplies to Antigua and assist with the evacuation of Barbuda, because the Antigua and Barbuda prime minister, I think his name's Gaston Brown, explained that Barbuda was in effect uninhabitable, especially with the menacing approach that has now thankfully receded of Hurricane Jose, which was following hard on the heels of Hurricane Irma. But Venezuela helped both with a couple of plane loads of supplies almost immediately, and also with the evacuation of the population from Barbuda.
Not only did we not hear about that, instead the media here started to lionize Peña Nieto for offering help from Mexico because it's something that they could beat Trump up with. But they neglected to report on the character of Peña Nieto. The first thing I saw somebody post, some of our left friends were buying into this thing. You know, it was like, hello, maybe he could send us the 43 students. You know,
yeah.
this hero that we're discussing. But we did see that. We saw that Mexico was offering help to the United States because there's a political angle to that that's, you know, consistent with the public narrative here. But Venezuela, Cuba, you know, those folks offering help here, we don't see that in our media at all.
Well, yeah, so maybe we should move on to other stuff, Don, because I know obviously that whole issue is going to play out. I'm very much as we framed it, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Although it's quite depressing to
sorry.
For people on the ground.
Yes, it is.
Elsewhere, I mean, something important that happened, a very important visit by the Pope to Colombia, of course.
Yeah.
Pope Francis visited Colombia during 5 days, and he was there from September the 6th to September the 10th.
And a very important time in Colombia's history, of course.
Yeah. And his visit was very important, but it's open to, in terms of consolidating the peace process in Colombia, but it's an open question what it'll mean in the short term, in practical terms.
Right.
And so the immediate problem that's facing Colombia is that the narco paramilitaries, so closely associated with the extreme right wing in Colombia, and in the past that have been associated with even the what might be called the mainstream oligarchy, as represented by Juan Manuel Santos, the current president.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they still play a very important and pernicious role in Colombia's political, economic, and social life, because they've taken over areas that used to be protected by the FARC guerrilla. Obviously, when the FARC demobilized for the paramilitaries, and that was a great opportunity to extend their influence, and that's what they've done. And there's been no let up in the incidents of murders of human rights defenders, murders of community activists, including murders of demobilized FARC fighters and their families.
Yeah, which you had mentioned concern about that, you know, back when they had announced the terms of the treaty again, even before.
Yeah, and so that's fundamental. And also this current stage where the peace process is at, whereby the FARC have and their leadership and their grassroots rank and file membership, they've complied to the letter with the terms of the Colombian peace agreement. But the government authorities, the Colombian authorities, and as their long track record in almost every sphere, both domestic and international, would lead you to expect, they're dragging their feet and changing the rules as they go along, and they're kind of playing this kind of extremely damaging game in terms of the success of the peace process in Colombia, whereby the legislature will kind of palm off some difficult issue to the judiciary, who then palm it off and back to the legislature or onto the executive, the government. And so between the executive power, the legislative power, and the judicial power in Colombia, they're effectively slowing down the implementation and changing the rules of the implementation of the peace process. So will the Pope's visit be some kind of give some kind of impetus to the peace process, so that those attempts at slowing it down and changing the rules don't have as damaging an impact as they might otherwise have? Or will it just be turn out to have been an elaborate public relations stunt, enabling the Colombian authorities to kind of cover up what they're actually trying to do in terms of implementing the peace process?
Like,
and time will tell.
Like last time, by the way, there's a history of that before.
Right. Yeah, and so the Colombian government is notorious. I mean, even in the case of a very clear-cut judgment by the International Court of Justice in the case where they had to adjudicate the maritime territory in a dispute between Nicaragua and Colombia. The Colombian authorities have spent the last, when was that judgment? End of 2013?
Yeah, it's 3,
and over the last
ago,
4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And the Colombian authorities have just dragged their feet recognizing that judgment. Although that's mostly got to do with Colombian public opinion, and the Colombian authorities seem to have accepted the practical implications of that judgment. But it's another example of how they deal with things they don't like.
Yeah.
and how the Colombian elites deal with things they don't like, and they'll engage in agreements and then backpedal like crazy, and in when it comes to their practical implementation. So let's see what happens as a result of the Pope's visit in Colombia, if anything.
Yeah.
Then elsewhere, in Guatemala, we've talked in the past, Don, about the way corruption as a motif is exploited by local elites and by their U.S. And Western European backers,
right,
to attack governments they don't like. And the clearest example of that was the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff back in whenever it was. Correct. Now. Was it 2016?
2015, 2016. Yeah, over the course of that period.
It seems like ancient history now, doesn't it?
Yep.
But in Guatemala, there's a very clear case where people listening may remember what happened to Otto Perez and Otto Perez's vice president Roxana, I think, is Baldetti, and they were caught up in a corruption scandal that they were very clearly implicated in, and they ended up doing jail time.
Right.
And as a result of that, Jimmy Morales, the current Guatemalan president, came to power.
Right.
But he's caught up in scandal somewhat, not quite as serious as the scandal that brought down Otto Perez, right, but very, very similar. And he's two of his son and his brother are accused of committing fraud, and his political party is accused of, and he himself was accused of making illicit use of electoral campaign funding that they didn't declare.
Right.
And the mechanism for attacking Jimmy Morales, the current Guatemalan president, has been the UN Commission Against Impunity and Corruption in Guatemala.
Like without Otto Perez and the La Linea. I mean, but what happened to Perez Molina was that with help from the UN, there was evidence presented of a customs corruption where you basically pay for discounted tariffs. You give some payments or kickbacks to government officials, and you get a reduction in your tariffs. That's what took him down, although there were also the allegations of human rights abuses during the Civil War, the killing, involvement with Girardi's killing and others. But otherwise, the particular thing that got him out is very similar to what's being used against Jimmy now. Maybe his maybe some telling bad jokes also might be part of his problem.
No, he's never going to shake off the fact that he was a very popular comedian. But he seems to be better able to defend himself than Otto Perez was, because his party, the National Convergence Alliance, that brought him to power, backed by a different section of the corrupt Guatemalan elite, with the support of the United States back then. His party just paid something like a $60,000 fine to the electoral authority that enables them to continue operating. They'd fallen into they'd failed to comply with a judicial order. And that meant that the electoral authority suspended their right to any kind of political activity in the country.
Right.
And imagine what would happen if one of the political parties in the United States was in breach of a judicial ruling, and it was they couldn't hold any kind of meeting at any level anywhere in the United States.
Right, I know. It's pretty interesting. You have the tradition in Guatemala of the military in particular having, you know, their hands in everything. We got to come back to this next week because we're out of time. And I'd like to thank you very much, Tony, for your time as usual. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks, me and Don. Let's see what we can catch up with next time.
You got it. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.